Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of the relief effort underway on the devastated island of Puerto Rico that Donald Trump has turned into a contentious political issue in a flurry of 18 tweets on Saturday that were full of anger and blame and completely lacking in compassion, inspiration, hope, and leadership that presidents usually offer to their fellow Americans at a time of need and a time for unity. Alexander Betancourt, the chair of the Department of Political Science and professor at the University of Puerto Rico, joins us to provide a local perspective on what is happening in Puerto Rico compared to the rosy self-congratulation coming from Trump, who again is addressing the alternative universe of his base inside the Fox News Sinclair right-wing talk radio bubble, feeding them his brazenly cynical lies while attacking the rest of the media for reporting what they are seeing with their own eyes as the American citizens on this small hurricane-ravaged island search for food, water, medicine, and their missing loved ones. Then we'll go to Spain for an update on today's violently contested referendum over the independence of Catalonia that the Madrid government is forcefully shutting down by closing polling places and arresting voters trying to cast ballots, injuring up to 500. Anthony Geist, a professor of Spanish and comparative literature, who is the vice chair of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives and author of They Still Draw Pictures, Children's Drawings from the Spanish Civil War, joins us to discuss how much this referendum is exhuming the ghosts of the Spanish Civil War as Catalonians, young and old, are being beaten up by the national police for expressing their independence. Then finally, we'll get a critique of the PBS series on the Vietnam War by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick from Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He joins us to discuss how the Vietnam War was many wars, not just in Vietnam, but inside the White House, between the press and the government, and on the streets of America between protesters and supporters. And now let's go to an interview which I recorded just before coming on the air. We had to improvise because the phones are down in Puerto Rico. And joining us now is Alex Betancourt, who's chair of the Department of Political Science and professor at the University of Puerto Rico. And because the telephones are down, I had to send him the questions, and he sent me back recordings of the answers, which we edited together shortly before coming on the air today. Alex, on Saturday, President Trump tweeted out 18 tweets, mostly angry, full of blame. He attacked the mayor of San Juan, implying that the Puerto Ricans are lazy, they expect everything to be done for them. Given that the island is devastated, there's no water, food, medicine, or electricity, it strikes me as being insensitive, even racist. How does it strike you?
President Trump's comments regarding Puerto Ricans' lack of self-reliance is a classic example of imperial discourse regarding its colonial territory. Historically speaking, the political discourse of domination has always portrayed the dominated as deserving of their condition. The logic of blaming the victim takes many forms, usually accompanied by a racial or ethnic component. It is important to point out that responding logically to the charge of laziness by enumerating all our individual and collective efforts in all areas, such response would be a waste of time. It would be a waste of time because Trump's comments are pathological, and it's quite difficult, if not impossible, to reason with a pathology. It is pathological because it's an idea of a people based on preconceived notions rather than reality. The president's sensitivity in terms of an emotional response is not something that I would consider important. On that score, to put it bluntly, he's an equal opportunity offender. What I think is more insidious, politically speaking, has to do with how the president keeps responding to critical situations in his celebrity mode. This is something that not only affects Puerto Rico, especially under our current circumstances, but that will also have consequences on the mainland. As citizens, we should ask ourselves, what are the political consequences of a commander-in-chief that governs as if he were still on The Apprentice? And more importantly, what has happened to our political culture when millions of citizens find this style of government appealing?
Are people on the island who have no phones or TV or radio aware that President Trump is repeatedly telling the American people what a great job he's doing in response to the crisis that you're enduring there? He keeps saying that people are amazed at the amazing job that the Trump administration is doing. How does it look from Puerto Rico?
News travel quickly, and as you are well aware, presidential news travel particularly fast, even without phones or TVs. While there's very little electricity in Puerto Rico, around 25%, I think, of cell phones are working, and several radio stations are up and running. Hence, the president's comments are national news here in Puerto Rico. This is to say that most people are aware of the president's constant self-congratulatory assessment. I think this is something Governor Rosselló and the president have in common, actually. The difference is that Rosselló is very articulate and has a strong command of his discourse. After all, he holds degrees from MIT and the University of Michigan. What I find most striking about the president's lack of self-reflexivity is that he probably believes that he is doing an amazing job, that he is the best at everything. While I think there is something comic about the whole "I am the greatest" attitude, there is a political problem with it. You see, when a regular Joe thinks he is God's gift to the world, that makes him a fool. But when the most powerful politician in the country thinks he's infallible, that makes him a liability for democracy. If all you want to hear is the sound of your own voice, then you end up surrounding yourself with echoes. When dissent is considered treasonous, critical thinking is criminalized, and when you start to criminalize critical thought, you undermine the very essence of politics and the foundations of historical progress.
Trump's blaming local truck drivers for the bottleneck of aid in the ports of not getting out to the countryside, but the mayor's blaming the FEMA bureaucracy. So what's the real story about why the aid's not getting distributed?
I don't think anyone can give you the answer to that question. Everybody has a different story regarding the bottleneck in the port. The truck drivers' union say one thing, the governor is constantly saying that everything is under control and organized, and there is the issue of bureaucracy, and then there is the catch-22 of diesel fuel. Most truck drivers live in rural areas, which were the most affected areas of the island. This means that diesel is not getting there, and the trucks needed to distribute aid, they run on diesel. I truly have no idea who's telling the truth, but I do have a strong feeling that most of what we are getting are half-truths, which is another way of saying lies.
Trump has brought up the issue of Puerto Rico's debt on repeated occasions. So what does it tell you about what will be forthcoming in terms of reconstruction and who will be paying for it?
Puerto Rico's debt, along with the Fiscal Oversight Board established by Congress under President Obama's administration, was probably the most pressing issue we were facing before the devastation caused by Hurricane Maria. the debt still stands, and we can be sure that bond holding companies, as well as their insurers and lobbyists, are knocking at Congress and the president's door seeking to ensure their money. A few days ago, actually, a group of bondholders for the electric energy company offered $1 billion loan to the public corporation, who already have about $9 billion in debt. I don't think taking a loan is a good idea. Taking loans you won't be able to pay back place Puerto Rico in financial trouble in the first place. So repeating that mistake is not the way to go. So what we really are going to need is massive assistance from Congress for the reconstruction effort, rather than digging deeper into the debt hole.
Will there be an exodus of Puerto Ricans to the mainland? And given the nature of Trump's racist tweets and dog whistle appeals to his base in terms of stirring up anti-immigrant scapegoating, it would seem that ironically you could make the argument that he ought to take care of the people in Puerto Rico, otherwise they'll show up here on the mainland. I know that sounds cynical, but there's nothing more cynical than what Trump is doing in terms of racist tweets and scapegoating.
That would be a very dangerous game to play for several reasons. First of all, the "they will show up in your doorstep" game ironically plays right into the anti-immigrant racist fantasy. Thousands of Puerto Ricans have been leaving the island for years. This is a problem for us, not for the United States. The tragedy of poor people is that they do not have the resources to get out of the island. So to use them as a threat is really adding insult to injury. Sociologically and demographically speaking, it's mostly the young, educated, and professional classes who have been leaving the island, which is a huge problem for Puerto Rico. It depletes the tax base. It means the United States, instead of Puerto Rico, will get many of our best brains. Most of them graduated from the University of Puerto Rico, which is mostly publicly funded. Hence, after the taxpayers of Puerto Rico have subsidized the best we have to offer, the great peoples of New York, Florida, Philadelphia, and Texas will have the benefits of their services and the taxes of their income.
In response to Trump's attacks on her, it seems like the mayor is trying to point out that she's never said anything nasty to Trump. She was only trying to get aid and get their attention. But in this alternative fact-free universe with Fox, Sinclair, and right-wing talk radio echoing Trump's talking points, however fraudulent and fictional they are, would it make sense for her to take a different tack and say what a great guy Trump is and how he can work miracles, and we can't wait to see him on Tuesday to show up and solve all of our problems? Maybe that's a tactic she should use.
The recovery and reconstruction of Puerto Rico is going to be a long, complicated, and difficult process. Very difficult. The mayor of San Juan and President Trump recent exchanges are also an instance of media-driven fuss. This is not to say that the mayor's concerns are not legitimate. They certainly are, and I have no doubt whatsoever of her sincerity and profound sense of responsibility during this devastation. I also think that Trump's characterization of Mayor Cruz is off base. But we should not forget that these two are politicians who are also playing politics in a way. As a politician, Mayor Cruz's career has been quite formidable. The problem with the media fuss generated by their exchange is that it has more to do with the news cycle than its its constant search for political controversy than with tending to our pressing needs. Trump's visit will probably be hectic, and he'll probably tweet about the amazing people of Puerto Rico and will probably characterize things as the best of this or that. However, a few days after his visit, the news cycle will be onto something else. But our focus must be on the long-term institutional support and infrastructure that will be needed for rebuilding the island.
I understand that the mayor of San Juan belongs to one political party and the governor belongs to another, more conservative, pro-Republican party. Does that explain the governor's fealty towards Trump?
Let me give you a little bit of political background regarding Mayor Cruz and Governor Rosselló. While both of them are Democrats in terms of U.S. politics, they belong to opposing political parties in Puerto Rico. Many people believe that the mayor will be running for governor in the next election. So while it may seem petty to be thinking candidacy in a time of profound crisis, that is what politicians always do. Governor Rosselló's main political goal is and always has been making Puerto Rico the 51st state of the Union. While I don't think that's ever going to happen, his entire government agenda is based not only on Puerto Rico becoming a state, but significant parts of his platform take that illusion as a reality. As far as he's concerned, upsetting the president undermines the statehood project. So the mayor's battle with the president can only be seen by the governor as a setback for his larger project. He also must be really upset that his main political adversary has been making international news for several consecutive days, thus obscuring the governor's own efforts.
What's the status of the dam in the northeast that's supposedly about to burst?
The governor just ordered an evacuation impacting the towns of Isabela and Quebradillas, the closest to the dam. At the same time, the mayors of both towns, after having a meeting with the U.S. Corps of Engineers, insist that the situation is under control and are asking the governor to withdraw the evacuation order. Really, there is a lot of confusion regarding this situation.
When will we know about the full scope of the damage, both in terms of property and the loss of human life?
I think it's going to take at least a year to know the full scope of the damage in terms of property. Regarding the loss of human life, we won't know the magnitude of this tragedy until communications with all municipalities can be restored.
When do you expect to have food, water, electricity, access to money, and medicine?
The electric energy company estimates it will take 6 months to restore the system, which was severely compromised to begin with. So I think when they say that it will take 6 months, I think they mean to get it back to a working but severely compromised state. According to the water company, they are up to 50% capacity. I have no idea about the veracity of that information. Issues of access to money and medicine are closely related to the geographical area and, of course, to issues of class.
So just in closing, Alex, does waiving the Jones Act to get supplies in mean we'll be forced to debate citizenship without representation and reevaluate Puerto Rico's colonial status?
There should be no doubt that we are second-class citizens. From the Jones Act to PROMESA, the relation between the USA and Puerto Rico has been characterized by domination. In this sense, while Trump's tweets are usually immature and childish, it's not like former presidents have taken serious steps to addressing the political status of Puerto Rico. Regardless of the campaign promises that Democrats as well as Republicans make every 4 years to Puerto Rican politicians, The truth of the matter is that every president's response to the political status has been the same. That is, you are what you are and will remain such, second-class citizens.
And I've been speaking with Alex Betancourt, who is chair of the Department of Political Science and a professor at the University of Puerto Rico. Because the phones are down, we were unable to do a live interview. I sent him questions, and he sent me back recordings of the answers, which we edited together just before coming onto the air this morning. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and then go to Spain to get an update on the referendum in Catalonia that the government of Spain is violently shutting down. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Anthony Geist, who's a professor of Spanish and comparative literature at the University of Washington, whose field of research concerns art and literature of the Spanish Civil War. He is the vice chair of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives, and his latest book is They Still Draw Pictures, Children's Drawings from the Spanish Civil War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anthony Geist.
Yes, thank you, Ian. Good to hear you.
Well, thank you for joining us from Spain. And do you think that in the broader sense, this referendum in Catalonia that the government is trying to shut down, and we can get into the details of some of their rather brutal tactics, is exhuming the ghosts of the Spanish Civil War?
That's a very interesting question, actually. It's an extremely divisive event that's taking place, both the referendum, the central government's response to it, reaction to it, and then internally within Catalonia and and throughout Spain. The tensions between Catalonia and the Catalan independence movement and the central government go way back farther than the Spanish Civil War, really to the origins of Spain as a modern nation. Spain, in some senses, we can understand Spain, the unification of Spain, as being brought about by force, by military force. And I'm referring to the consolidation of Castile and Aragon, and Catalonia was part of Aragon under Ferdinand and Isabella. So we're talking, late 15th century. So those tensions have been prevalent, really, and to a greater or lesser extent for centuries. During the Spanish Civil War itself, actually the Spanish Republic, which was declared when King Alfonso XIII abdicated in 1931, granted both Catalonia and the Basque Country autonomy. That is basically the equivalent of states' rights, but particularly recognizing their right to self-government within the larger federation of Spain, of the Spanish Republic, and the right to use and to teach their own language and to follow their own traditional political traditions and law codes, really. So that ended, of course, with Franco's victory at the end of the Civil War, And there was tremendous repression in Catalonia, in the Basque, throughout the country, but with particular virulence in Catalonia and the Basque country.
So, Anthony Geist, again, professor of Spanish and comparative literature at the University of Washington. His field of research concerns art and literature of the Spanish Civil War. He's the vice chair of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives, and his latest book is They Still Draw Pictures, Children's Drawings from the Spanish Civil War. My understanding is, of course, Rajoy, the prime minister in Madrid, is with the Conservative Party. He chose, I think, one of the most conservative judges on the Spanish Supreme Court, their equivalent of Antonin Scalia, to issue the ruling to shut down the Catalonian referendum and make it illegal. And since then, we've had a cat and mouse game between the Guardia Civil and the other Spanish National Police forces, tearing up ballots, ripping up printing presses, closing down polling stations. There's been a real cat and mouse. I imagine you're seeing it all there on Spanish television. Farmers have put up tractors. Yeah, go ahead. Describe the scenes.
Please go ahead. Pardon me.
No, so describe these scenes of this kind of cat and mouse guerrilla efforts on the part of the citizens to vote and the government to stop them voting.
Right. Well, it's part of it. The biggest confrontations apparently took place earlier in the day in Catalonia, and with particular intensity in Barcelona. The Mossos de Esquadra, which are the Catalan police of the autonomous region of Catalonia, have for the most part not followed orders from the central government to shut down the polling places. So this is a central government sent in the Guardia Civil, as well as the National Police Force. The Guardia Civil are actually a branch of the military and operate throughout Spain. And there were violent confrontations earlier in the day at a number of the polling stations, resulting in about 500 people injured and being treated at hospitals, including several policemen, but large numbers of citizens. So it's been extremely interesting. The latest news that I've seen says that by some reports, 96% of the polling stations did manage to remain open, and people voted. The internet was cut off, so the voting has been done by written ballot. And they've actually a number of the polling stations closed early so that they could begin counting the ballots. Out of fear of being shut down by the civil guard before 8 o'clock, which is when the polls officially closed. As we speak now, Prime Minister Rajoy is addressing the nation. It's on being televised. I can't see what he's saying because I've turned the sound down. And so it'll be extremely interesting to see what the results of the referendum will be.
Well, even here in the state of California, there have been some movements for secession, although it turned out that one of the leader of one of these secession movements was actually living in Russia, and it was a part of Putin's efforts to sow division in the West, because he supports, needless to say, the Catalonian referendum.
Yes, exactly.
But, there's a basis to the California claim, which is that we send more money to Washington than we get back, considerably more, whereas the state of Mississippi gets more federal money than they give back in forms of tax revenues. So is that happening there? Because, we're in a country where we have a president who only represents the red states and his shrinking constituency of angry white people and Christian conservatives in the red state America. He doesn't in any way attempt to discuss or acknowledge the majority of people in this country because they didn't vote for him.
That's exactly right, yes. And I think that, that is a fair analogy, actually, with in a sense, with what's going on, there's the analogy between California and Catalonia. The thing is that I think if it were put to a referendum in California, I wonder how many people would actually vote for secession from the Union. I think there is a much stronger sense in the United States of union. And in fact, you know, we fought a civil war over this, for a bloody war for 4 years. When the Civil War was over and Abraham Lincoln was asked, why are you letting, or how will you bring them back in? He said they never left. That was what the whole war was about. So I think this is, but, you know, this is a different matter. I mean, Catalonians do have their own language, their own culture, their own set of customs, which are different from, you know, the other parts of Spain, on the one hand. But on the other hand, there are a number of different, what I've seen from talking both on the news here, but also with talking with a number of different people, and I was just in Barcelona last weekend, and in the Basque Country earlier this week, there are a number of different positions on this referendum. One is, of course, of those in favor of independence, who have designed a new Catalan flag, a new Catalan independence flag, which we saw everywhere, people wearing it as a cape hung over their shoulders. There are other people who believe that while they may or may not support secession or Catalan independence, do believe that there should be a democratic right to vote. And the fact of the matter is that in several articles of the Constitution, the Spanish Constitution of 1978, it does specifically and explicitly forbid movement toward independence and votes and referenda on those things. And then, there were huge counter demonstrations on Saturday of people showing the Spanish colors, the Spanish flag, against the referendum. So it's extremely complicated. And then there are those within Catalonia who are opposed to independence as well.
But demonstrations, Tony, the ones that you mentioned, pro-government demonstrations, were they in Madrid or in Barcelona?
Yes. No, they were in Madrid, primarily in Madrid. There were smaller ones in Catalonia, mm-hmm. And which resulted in confrontations with the pro-independence people as well.
So what is the fate and future then of Carles Puigdemont, the Catalan leader? A number of leaders were arrested and detained before the elections. Puigdemont had a hard time voting. They closed down the first place he went to vote, and he went to another place and eventually voted. So one wonders what the point of whatever the numbers come out. They won't represent the full intentions of the voters of Catalonia. But what will be But what will be the retribution from the central government?
Well, that'll be really interesting. I think this puts Rajoy, the prime minister, in an extremely difficult position because he's been very pusillanimous, been unwilling to take a strong position leading up to this, and really until the very last minute when it was too late. Spain has been in a political crisis for the last several years. Remember, 2 or 3 years ago, with the emergence of the two new parties of Podemos and Ciudadanos, Rajoy has had to is governing from through a coalition, and I think this will weaken him considerably. I'm not sure what will happen. I don't know what will happen with Puigdemont, quite frankly. And I haven't heard much speculation from people I've talked with about that.
Well, just in closing, what is the is there a possibility then that you could have a broader resistance coalition formed with the Catalonians, with the Basques, and with the youth, the unemployed youth? I mean, Podemos seems to have sort of floundered. It came on with a big rush, expectation, but it doesn't seem to have delivered. So will this contested referendum breathe new life into the political left in Spain?
Well, that'll be really very interesting to see, and I think particularly will be interesting to see how willing they are to reach across ideological and party lines. I was just in the Basque Country a couple of days ago. There were a lot of Catalan independence flags flying. We saw demonstrations in San Sebastian with people marching, very young people, it looked like high school students, marching in the streets with the Coruña, the Basque flag, and with the Catalan independence flag. So there may be a consolidation across those lines, and I don't know what Podemos is likely to do, or how they will be able to navigate this situation.
Well, Anthony Geist, I thank you very much for joining us from Spain. I appreciate it.
Ian, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Anthony Geist, who's a professor of Spanish and comparative literature at the University of Washington, whose field of research concerns art and literature of the Spanish Civil War. He is the vice chair of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives, and his latest book is They Still Draw Pictures, Children's Drawings from the Spanish Civil War. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with a critique of the PBS series on the Vietnam War by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And the PBS series on the Vietnam War has garnered some fairly rave reviews by and large, but also a lot of criticism, mostly from people on the political left in this country, particularly those that identified or even participated in the anti-war demonstrations. Your story, of course, is a part of the many Vietnam Wars. There wasn't just the Vietnam War in Vietnam itself. There was the Vietnam War inside the White House that you participated in. There was the Vietnam War in between the press and the government, the secret CIA war, about which we don't know much, and the PBS series didn't really deal with that too much. And then, of course, the other war on the streets of America between protesters and supporters of the war. So let's start with your war. How did you feel about the way the series dealt with your war inside the White House?
Well, I think that they obviously neglected major parts of it. Though they had a monumental collection of film and television archives. Vietnam, of course, was the first televised war. They had a lot of material to work with. Telling the story of what happened in Washington, Ian, as you know, was much more a matter of investigative reporting. It wasn't so much visual as it was substantive and intellectual. It needed more historical perspective, obviously, on the origins of the Cold War, on the sociology of knowledge in Washington, the evolution of the post-war foreign policy decision-making establishment, all of that figured in the Vietnam tragedy. And not least, of course, you've got the transition of the presidency from John F. Kennedy to Lyndon Baines Johnson. And that's a terribly important chapter, which I don't think they've dealt with at all adequately. So my war was fought, of course, in carpeted offices in the White House and in the what's now the Eisenhower Building, the Executive Office Building next door. It was often, we thought then, in its own way, brutal and savage in an intellectual sense, that dissent and the kind of authentic discussion of policy options was never really allowed. There was a blanketing consensus under McGeorge Bundy and the initial National Security Council staff under Jack Kennedy, although that had begun to change toward Kennedy's last days of his life, and we now have evidence that he really was contemplating and had ordered an end to American involvement in Vietnam, really the pullout of major portion of American advisory troops, et cetera. All of that changed with Lyndon Johnson and with the advent of Walt Rostow, who was my immediate boss at the National Security Council staff. This was the regime of hawks who believed that Vietnam was a crucial historic moment in the larger history of the Cold War, that we were necessarily rolling back not simply communism from Moscow, but of course the expansion of communist China as well. All of that turned out to be faulty in historical terms, and certainly tragic in terms of the cost on the ground.
Well, of course, it's hardly a surprise that the minute the Vietnam War ended, Vietnam and China went to war. I mean, the blindness that we had about this kind of global communist conspiracy, you know, as though they were all marching in lockstep, was, of course, a huge part of the blindness. But at the end of the day, weren't we fighting a birth rate? And I find the greatest irony about the Vietnam War was that the minute that the United States stopped fighting the Vietnam War, they won the war, because the Vietnamese then begged for reparations and for reconstruction and rattled the tin cup. And you know, they were the North Vietnamese were great at fighting, but as we've seen since, pretty pathetic at governing.
Well, I think the American conduct was obviously based on an ignorance of history in Southeast Asia, an ignorance of the relationship between China and Vietnam, for that matter, an ignorance of the relationship evolving then so explosively in the Sino-Soviet schism, the real split and division in the communist world that was not adequately recognized even by the latter 1960s inside the U.S. government. Yes, I think that America had lost, in a sense, in 1954, when Vietnam was divided by the Geneva Conference, one of those instances of John Foster Dulles, the famous bull who carried around his own China shop, and the American side never really understood. This is what I saw and felt again and again in Washington and at the higher levels of the U.S. government. Never really understood, perceived, had any genuine sensibility for the nationalist impulse that brought all of those young Vietnamese, North and South, padding down in their sandals the Ho Chi Minh Trail, giving their lives in what was nothing less than in their nationalist terms, a noble sacrifice for the unity of that country, for its independence, in the first instance from colonial domination by the French and then by the Americans, and then, of course, independence from China and any other outside power. And they took the aid they were given and used it fairly effectively. But this was all about the independence of Vietnam. And you're quite right. The post-war Vietnam turned out to be a rather different place. And we now appreciate its food more than we did, I think, during the war, and its beautiful scenery, which we tried to devastate and destroy, literally to defoliate. And it's a very different world now, of course.
And again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Probably tomorrow, Roger, I'm going to be talking to a leading anti-war activist who was featured in the Ken Burns Lynn Novick series on PBS, The Vietnam War. And as I mentioned earlier, there have been some criticism of it not fully addressing the anti-war movement. And being a little too rosy in terms of the history. And, of course, there's no way that you can even begin to describe the kind of brutality meted out particularly by your former boss, President Nixon, in terms of the bombing. And the amount, the tonnage of bombs was greater than World War II on this tiny country. I mean, it was just the brutality of the most powerful nation on the earth trying to bend the will of this tiny country who refused to give up and didn't give up is pretty extraordinary. But
all the worst elements in American foreign policy inherited from both World War I and World War II and the interwar period. All of the worst elements of relative ignorance of the world, our total unpreparedness to assume the kind of world power that we inherited in 1945, the implicit and explicit racism, which characterized America's treatment, of course, of its own non-white population, but characterized almost every relationship we had with non-white third world people in this era of supposed competition with the Soviet Union for influence and for affection on the part of those very people. The other element, of course, is the utter arrogance of American power, which was so much the product of the victory in World War II. The officers who ran Vietnam, Ian, were, of course, the young officers, the young successful officers, many of them rapidly promoted, of an army which regarded itself by 1945 as invincible, and regarded its principles and its methods, its operations, as absolutely unconquerable. Now, we had, ironically, and given the current crisis of the Trump administration in Korea, we had a rather graphic and awful dress rehearsal for all of this in the stalemate in Korea. We had learned the hard way, having gone all the way to the Yalu and, in effect, challenged the Chinese. We had learned, being thrown back to Central Korea, the vulnerability to a disciplined Asian force. This was not something that had been part of the catechism at West Point or elsewhere. We knew that there were constraints on war that had never operated before, Korea was the first genuinely limited war in the shadow of nuclear power by the United States and the Soviet Union. There were boundaries drawn politically as well as militarily that were not crossed. All of that was present before the major American commitment in Vietnam, and it was very, very largely ignored. So it brought together all of the prejudice and all of the intellectual shallowness and the bigotry of the American military and political establishment. And that, of course, is reflected in turn in the way they responded to and reacted to the anti-war movement at home in the United States, which you will remember was savagely ridiculed and discounted, dismissed, really, until it could no longer be ignored in its sheer numbers and in its political impact. But initially, even though I remember the early teach-ins at Harvard in the early 1960s, even though the anti-war movement in its origins was the first glimmer of a genuine intellectual understanding of what was happening in Vietnam, all of that was not simply discounted, but savagely attacked and ridiculed, marginalized by the foreign policy establishment. So this was a colossal national failure of the United States, and I'm always a bit befuddled and dismayed by the use of the term greatest generation. I realized there was great heroism in World War II, but the leadership that emerged from World War II was so utterly unequipped and unable in every way, spiritually and intellectually, to deal with the power and the authority that we inherited. And much of the tragedy of the post-war era traces exactly to that. These were not men who were really prepared for world power.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, the one thing though that I think I'm not sure that it was necessarily the intention of Ken Burns and Lynn Novick to make the comparisons between the Vietnam War and, for example, the war in Afghanistan, but they're pretty inescapable. I mean, it's just like Groundhog Day. Aren't we repeating the same follies?
Oh yes. Oh yes. No. No. And you have a real sequence. We've talked about the many wars going on. There is a line of history about what's happening inside the U.S. military. The lessons of Vietnam were never really learned. You know, at the end of that war, there was an utter disintegration of the American army. I mean, the fragging and the mutinies, the race riots, the atrocities, etc. This became a kind of anomic mass that had once been this proud, invincible force out of World War II. And that crisis, that consummate crisis in the American military, was never really dealt with by any of the post-war presidential administrations, not by Carter, not by Reagan, not by any of them. It was left to the men who had led the war and who had never really learned its lessons. By the time you get to the Gulf War and that ersatz victory over such a minor power, by the time you get to the supposed vindication of American arms once again, you've got very much a replay of what went into Vietnam. So that the post 9/11 attacks in Afghanistan and certainly in Iraq tragically mirror exactly what happened in Vietnam. I hope they come to this point at some stage of the documentary history, because it's absolutely graphic.
Well, just in the last minute, we've talked quite a bit about the ongoing Russia scandal, or whatever you want to call it, with the Trump campaign, and you know, your relationship with Russia goes back a long way. You were a student at Moscow State University, and you have connections to some of the highest levels in Russian intelligence. My sense is that that what Mueller is zeroing in on now is really the, I think, the Achilles heel and the real smoking gun, which is that you know, Bannon and Mercer, the billionaire who pays for Bannon and Breitbart and his daughter Rebecca, they run Cambridge Analytica. They did a dress rehearsal with Brexit. And then they intimidated Facebook into getting rid of the human curation of the news, saying they had a political bias. And then once Zuckerberg rolled over and got rid of the human curators, then they switched to algorithms, and Cambridge Analytica were already with their algorithms to micro-target through social media all of the messaging of the Trump campaign. But that was done in alliance, at least it seems that way, with Russia, in terms of the Russians provided the bots and the troll farms to amplify that message. And that seems to be, there was all kinds of collusion. You know, obviously Jill Stein also played a part. And she certainly was connected to the Russians. That's what the Trump Steele dossier says. So there's lots of things to look at. But in your opinion, since you've been following this, do you think this is really where the rubber meets the road in terms of when?
Oh, this is far more important than any meetings, however ridiculous they may have been by members of the Trump family, Donald Jr. or the others. There were these sealers, of course, we know, that the FSB put out, and there were these contacts with the campaign. But yes, this is the essential nature and essence of the cooperation, which was the kind of social media targeting that the Russians could not do on their own, and only the Americans could have supplied this crucial information. And this is a part, of course, of the other major element I think that Mueller is looking at, which is the earlier financial compromise of Trump and of people around him, of crucial people in the campaign. We've still got, of course, the Flynn and Manafort dimensions to all of this. But this was the implementation. This was the day-to-day important campaign intervention that took place. And it's far more important than whether Donald Jr. was meeting with a Russian lawyer.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is The Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Tell stories to me about the places he had been to and the things that he had seen.